Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to begin a study of the book of Psalms. We'll start with chapter 1 in this audio, but before I go through chapter 1 of Psalms, I want to give you an introduction to the entire book of Psalms. First of all, who are the authors? Well, the authors are given attribution in the titles of each psalm, or many of the psalms. David, of course, is mentioned in a lot of them, 73 according to the NIV Study Bible. A gentleman named Asaph, who was, I think, a musical Levite, is mentioned as the author of some psalms, and then the sons of Korah are mentioned, Solomon is mentioned, and Moses is mentioned. So we have five different authors. Now, some people say that the titles of the psalms are not accurate, according to the NIV Study Bible. There are three common positions taken on the titles. First position is that all titles were written at the time the psalm was composed, and so the titles are inerrant because they're part of the scriptures. The second option concerning the titles is that some of the titles were inserted years after the respective psalms were written, and are thus likely to be inaccurate. The third position is that some of the titles were inserted years after the respective psalms were written, but they reflect an accurate tradition, which means we can generally take the title to be accurate, and that's what I'm going to go with. I will assume it's accurate. I won't claim it's inerrant, but I will assume it's accurate. One note on the Psalms of David, some say that when the title says a Psalm of David, that doesn't mean that David wrote it, but rather it means a Psalm in the manner or style of David, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Well, when I see a Psalm of David, I'm going to assume it's David. Just makes things easier. Now, the NIV Study Bible asked the questions, why was the book of Psalms written? Well, different authors had various reasons. For example, some of them were just making a song. They wanted to sing a psalm. Some were meditating and they wanted to have a poem of meditation. Some of them wanted to have a choir group singing. Sometimes they were soldiers marching off to war that needed something to be sung. So there's lots of reasons why the psalms were written. Now, what is the emphasis of the psalms? The emphasis is more on emotions than doctrine. The book of Psalms is not meant to be a collection of doctrinal essays. The authors are more interested in how something felt than what something means. Now, here are notes concerning the literary structure of the Psalms. First, concerning Hebrew poetry, the parallelism. Two different lines express exactly the same thought, or sometimes it's in one line, and the first part of the line and the second part of the line express the same thought, and that way you can actually, that helps you interpret sometimes. And you'll see this everywhere in the Old Testament scriptures. So you can equate two completely different expressions as meaning the same thing. Another interesting aspect of the Psalms, some of them are acrostics, which means the first letter of each section of the Psalm or each verse of the Psalm. When you take the first letter of each verse or each section of the Psalm and take those letters sequentially, it spells something. Either that or if it doesn't spell anything, the pattern of letters taken from the first verse of each Psalm, if those letters don't spell something, they might have a recognized pattern. Now, that's in the Hebrew. When you get to the translation, the acrostics are usually lost. I'll try to point those out when we get to them. Another note concerning the literary structure of the Psalms is the use of the term Selah, which is everywhere in the Psalms. As Adam Clark says, much has been said on the meaning of this word, and we have nothing but conjecture to guide us. So here are some conjectures. It can mean, quote, a pause in the psalm. The Septuagint actually translates Selah as pause in the psalm. The Amplified Bible for Selah says, pause and calmly think of that. The New Living Bible translates Selah as an interlude. But nobody knows what the word Selah means. The NIV note says it is a word of uncertain meaning, occurring frequently in the psalms, possibly a musical term. Most of the translations just leave it untranslated. Selah. Now, why is Psalms divided into five books? We're still talking about the literary structure. Well, the ancient scribes collected the Psalms and organized them. As the NIV Study Bible says, what were the criteria that the ancient scribes used in order to categorize the Psalms? Well, you had some Psalms written before the Babylonian exile, and so they would put those Psalms together. The first two books, as a matter of fact, are composed mainly of pre-exilic psalms. Sometimes the psalms might be grouped together because of language similarities. For example, If the psalm says, the Lord reigns, the Lord reigns, the Lord reigns, okay, we'll put these psalms together. Or praise the Lord, we'll put these psalms together. A third criterion used to group the psalms is to group them together because of their titles. For example, if it says a psalm of David, well, let's put those together. A psalm of Asaph, well, let's put those together. And then there are some psalms that are arbitrarily grouped. You cannot detect any criterion used for selection by the scribes. It could be just it was convenient for the scribe. He couldn't find a place to put them, so he just put them in the miscellaneous pile. Now, the psalms are quoted much in the New Testament. Adam Clark says that there are over 50 psalms quoted in the New Testament. That's a lot. That's a third of them. There are 150 psalms altogether. Now, let's look at this old theological chestnut, the problem of the imprecatory psalms. Let me read you some. Imprecatory means you're calling down a curse on your enemies. Psalm 58:6, O God, shatter their teeth and their mouth. Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord. Psalm 109:10, let his children wander about and beg, and let them seek sustenance far from their ruined homes. Psalm 137:8-9, O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one, how blessed will be the one who repays you with the recompense with which you have repaid us. How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock. Oh my gosh. So many people have trouble with these imprecatory psalms. How could a loving God do this? Actually, I don't have any trouble with them. In fact, I use them when I think of certain politicians of a certain political party and of a certain political persuasion, which I will not mention on this audio, but I use them all the time. Smash their teeth against the rocks. Now, I don't mean literally. I mean politically smash their teeth against the rocks. Now, I don't know whether the author of these three imprecatory psalms that I just read meant for their teeth to actually literally be shattered in their mouth, or literally that their children should wander about and beg. I don't know if they literally meant it, but even if they did literally mean it, we still have a problem. And I might point out to you, it's not just in the Old Testament. I mean, anybody teaches a different gospel than this, Paul says, let him be accursed. Is that not an imprecation? Well, before I give you some options on how we can view these imprecatory psalms, I must say that a lot of the problem comes because the modern-day wussy-pussy evangelical Christian is afraid of God's judgment. He doesn't want to talk about it. He wants to talk about love, 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 love. He wants to say with Rob Bell that love wins and there can't be any judgment. Well, you've got to be a blind fool to read the Bible and think there's not judgment in there, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Little Jesus, meek and mild, as he turns over the tables of the money chambers in the temple. All right, well, let's look at the problem of the imprecatory psalms. The first thing we have to do is how do we reconcile that with the New Testament command against vengeance being taken toward one's enemies? For example, in the New Testament, Paul says in Romans 12:19, never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And then, of course, the famous Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5:44, Jesus says, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Now, there's a very simple answer to this. Paul and Jesus in these two verses are talking about personal revenge. They are not talking about judicial actions taken toward lawbreakers. I mean, after all, the same Paul that wrote, never take your own revenge is the same Paul that said God gave the sword to the government to execute wrath on evildoers in Romans 13. The difference is one is a governmental function, the other is private. Same thing with Jesus. Jesus was saying, don't take private revenge on people. He was never saying that the government has no right to execute people or to harm people. I mean, after all, this same Jesus who said, turn the other cheek, is the same Jesus who told his disciples to take a sword in Luke 22. Now, why would he do that? So they could cook pancakes on the sword? No, so they could stab people that tried to rob them. So we need to distinguish very carefully the categories of private and public, individual versus governmental. All right, with that background, let's look at some suggested solutions of the imprecatory Psalms. And I want to do it now at the introduction so I don't have to keep going over this as we go through the book of Psalms. I don't want to keep mentioning, here's the problem of the imprecatory psalms, and so forth. I want to keep it somewhat short. Well, here's the first solution. David was just sinning when he said this, but God wasn't sinning. Well, that's crazy. That's not true. David was not sinning. Was Jesus sinning when he said, take a sword? Was Paul sinning when he said, The government needs to put fear in the heart of evildoers, and government has the power of the sword, which means to kill people. No, David's not sinning. And remember, David's a king. He's in the government. This suggested solution to the problem of the imprecatory Psalms is that David was bitter and poured out his heart to God. That's better than taking vengeance into his own hands, and so he's just pouring out his heart to God. Well, that's still sinning, is it not? You're not supposed to be bitter. As a matter of fact, even the government's not supposed to be bitter. When the executioner pulls the switch, he should not have any emotions toward that sinner. He should be happy that the law is being upheld, but he should be sad that the defendant, the murderer, has to be executed. He should be sad about it. So I don't think this is a good defense of David, just to say he was bitter. He had a right to talk bitter because he was bitter, but at least he wasn't trying to hurt anybody. Well, one reason that doesn't work is David actually was kind to many of his enemies, not bitter toward them. Remember at the Rocks of the Wild Gate near En-Gedi, where David caught Saul, his bitter enemy, sleeping, 1 Samuel 24:5, it came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. Cut off the edge of Saul's robe. Ooh, that's really violent. And he felt bad about that. And then at Jeshimon, in 1 Samuel 26:5-9, this is near, well, it's at a place called Jeshimon. This is again where David caught Saul sleeping. Let me read that for you. 1 Samuel 26, 5-9. David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Saul was lying in the circle of the camp. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" So David didn't kill his enemy then. He was kind to his enemies. How about Mephibosheth, who would have been an heir to the house of Saul after Saul had died at Bethshan in his last battle with the Philistines, 2 Samuel 9, 1-2. Then David said, "Is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul that I might show him, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. So David elevated a potential enemy there, Mephibosheth. So we're not going to take that as a reasonable solution that David was just bitter. We'll let him have a pass. No, he wasn't bitter when he was writing the imprecatory Psalms. So that's option number one, is how do we solve the problem of the imprecatory Psalms? They're just an expression of David's sinful emotions. They're not an expression of what God would actually want here. David was bitter and he was sinful. No, we're not going to take that one. Option number two, these Psalms were not imprecations, but prophecies. For example, let's read Psalm 137, 8 through 9 that way. "O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one, how blessed will be the one who repays you with the recompense with which you have repaid us." Notice there's not a direct imprecation on Babylon. It's just that we're going to bless those who destroy Babylon. Sort of an indirect imprecation. Verse 9. "How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock." All right, it's true. This is a prediction of the future. It's not a direct calling down of judgment upon the Babylonian's head, but I don't know. You could say, well, this is a simple prayer for future just retribution. After all, Babylon used to murder babies ripped out of the wombs of pregnant women. So, hallelujah, when the bad guys come to get the bad guys, or when whoever comes to get Babylon, hot dog, just like we rejoice when Hitler went down or when Osama bin Laden went down. I think that's a fine distinction. What's the distinction between Babylon? I wish that your enemy will seize and dash your little ones against the rock. Or, compared to that, how about this? How blessed will be the one who seizes and dash your little ones against the rock. That is a distinction without a difference to me. So let's look at the third option, that the imprecatory Psalms were a cry for justice, not vengeance. David was speaking in his judicial capacity as king of Israel. He was not speaking as a private individual, and the law allows, and in fact requires, officials to do what private citizens cannot do. I've already mentioned this when I was mentioning the problem in general, but Let's look at some New Testament scriptural examples of judicial wrath. Perfectly legitimate. Romans 13:4. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword. The government does not bear the sword. Capital S, capital W, capital O, capital R, capital D. The government does not bear the sword for nothing. It is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Oh, but God's a loving God. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't bring wrath on anybody's head. You want to bet? And I mentioned this verse already, Luke 22:36. And Jesus said to the disciples, But now whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag, and whoever has no sword, capital S, capital W, capital O, capital R, capital D, whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one. Now you might say, well, this is for private use, not for governments. Well, it's a sword to be used in self-defense when there are no cops around. As the law plainly says, even our modern law says, the defender acts in place of the government cop who can't get there in time. So if you shoot somebody who's trying to kill you, well, that's self-defense. That's all right. Now, we need to note that Jesus' function was not to enforce justice. He came to save sinners. He came not to destroy, but to save. And actually, he did that because he didn't need to condemn anybody because they were all condemned. Everybody on the earth was condemned because of original sin. And so his job was not to carry out justice. That was going to happen anyway. Even if Jesus had not come, all of mankind would have perished judicially under God's wrath. So his job was to get people saved. So naturally, Jesus is not going to be talking as much about destroying sinners. But he did do so sometimes. Remember all those verses on hell? Oh, all those verses that Rob Bell's hell denies? He's a heretic. Love wins. Yeah, well, you know what? If there is no hell, then Jesus was a liar. And I don't like it when people make Jesus out to be a liar, the Son of God. I really don't like that. How about his attacks on the Pharisees? You whitewashed tombs, you brood of vipers. How about his attack on the Pharisees in Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse? Not one stone's going to be left on top of another of the temple because I'm coming in judgment. How about all the book of Revelation, all the stuff that the angry Lamb of God is going to do to his enemies? Please, even Jesus talked about destroying sinners. Now, even though that was not his main mission when he came to the earth, he still talked about destroying sinners. So I like this solution, that the precatory psalms were a cry for justice, not a cry for private vengeance. Now, there's another fourth option how you can explain these imprecatory psalms. I don't agree with this option, like I don't agree with the first three options. And this fourth solution says this: there is a difference in standards for Old Testament saints and New Testament saints. How can we expect Old Testament saints to be living a Christian life before Christ even came? Well, there's that big distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Oh, there's no grace in the Old Testament. There's no judgment in the New. That is the biggest lie that ever was. It doesn't take long to disprove that myth. I've already mentioned this twice. I'll mention it again. Luke 22:36. Jesus tells his disciples to buy a sword. That's in the New Testament, folks. A sword is to kill the unrighteous people who try to rob them. And how about the Old Testament? Psalm 109:8 is quoted in the New Testament in Acts 1:20. Psalm 109:8 says, Let his days be few, let another take his office. And then Peter takes that psalm in Acts 1:20 and applies it to Judas, the traitor and betrayer of Jesus. For it is written in the book of Psalms, Let his homestead be made desolate, and let no one dwell in it, and let another man take his office. Those latter words are all capitalized in the NASB, which shows that they're taken from the Old Testament, namely Psalm 109:8. So you have the Psalms in the Old, the Psalms in the New, and of course, they're imprecatory. Let his homestead be made desolate. Let another man take his office. May bad things happen to you. So you can't really show a stark difference between the Old Testament saints and New Testament saints. So what's the answer? The answer is, in my humble opinion, the Psalms are a cry for justice, which are perfectly legitimate because justice is a legitimate activity of God. They are not a cry for vengeance because private vengeance is not a suitable activities for someone who loves God. We're supposed to love our enemies in our private capacities, but that doesn't mean that we can go to the government and say, I love my enemies. Don't pull the switch when you execute him. You can't do that. Now, another problem in the Psalms, there are a lot of generic references to enemies and battles. And in many of the Psalms which have these references, it is not clear as to which of David's enemies are being referred to. And there's a lot of speculation about who David's enemies are here. and I'm going to try to avoid such speculation. We'll just leave the enemies unspecified and generic and not worry about it. Now, another issue in the Book of Psalms is the use of the term Zion. Zion, the term, occurs over and over and over again in the Psalms. Now, what does Zion stand for? Well, this is generally accepted. It's not controversial. Physically, Zion refers to both the city of Jerusalem and by extension to the whole land of Israel. Let me read you from Wikipedia. Since the biblical era, the term Zion has been a synecdoche. A synecdoche is a literary device where a part stands for the whole, like the White House said this. That means the White House stands for the whole corrupt U.S. government. The White House stands for the whole government. Since the biblical era, the term Zion has been a synecdoche, Wikipedia says, referring to the entire city of Jerusalem and the land of Israel. Following this usage, the term is sometimes used to refer to a promised land in general. So Zion stands for the city of Jerusalem and the whole land of Israel. Not a problem, physically, to understand what Zion means. But what about spiritually? Zion is a common spiritual metaphor for the people of God in whom God dwells. I'm going to quote you a lot of Old Testament passages saying that, and New Testament passages too. The Old Testament passages refer to the Old Testament people of God. For example, in Psalms 2:6, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain." So when you see holy mountain, that's Zion. Psalm 15:1, "O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill?" Well, the answer to that is the people of God can dwell on that holy hill of Zion. Psalm 43:3, "Oh, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill." Bring me to Zion, where God lives. Bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling places. In Psalm 43:3, where you live. Isaiah 2:3, "And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord," that's Mount Zion, "to the house of the God of Jacob," to the house is where God lives, "that he may teach us concerning his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." There's the parallelism there. Zion means Jerusalem. Jeremiah 50, verse 5. "They will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in its direction. They will come that they may join themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten." So the people go to Zion where God lives, so they can join themselves to the Lord in a covenant. So Zion is the place where God lives and also where his covenant people live. And that is easy symbolism, and we will use it all the time. Now, to me, more interesting than the Old Testament symbolism of Zion is the New Testament symbolism of Zion. Hebrews 12:22, "But you have come to Mount Zion." The author of Hebrews is writing to Jewish Christians, and the author says, "But you, Christians, have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem." That's the New Testament people of God who have come to Mount Zion. How about Revelation 14:1? It's obviously New Testament. "Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion." There, that's the people of God, and of course that includes the New Testament people of God. 144,000, 12 tribes times 12 apostles, 12 times 12 is 144,000, means a lot of. That's Old Testament and New Testament. All right, so the symbolism of Zion is clear. It refers to the people of God. Now, where was Zion actually located? Now, that is an interesting thing. Within the city of Jerusalem, as I've already said, Zion is used to stand for the whole city of Jerusalem, but actually inside the city of Jerusalem, there was a particular area called Mount Zion. Now, if you look at the maps, it's easy to see where it is. If you see where the Temple Mount is, that's Mount Moriah. Then right south and a little bit east of Mount Moriah, you see a tongue of land that goes down between two valleys. On the western side of that tongue of land is the Tarpeian Valley, and on the eastern side of that tongue of land is the Kidron Valley, and on the south side is the Valley of Hinnom, and that tongue of land is Mount Zion. It's also called the City of David. So to summarize, Mount Zion can either be the City of David, that tongue of land between the two valleys, or it could refer to the whole city of Jerusalem by extension, and if you can extend its reference even further to the whole land of Israel. Now let's talk about the idea of the hidden God that we will find in the Book of Psalms. The hidden God, the Latin term for that is Deus Absconditus. Now, the hidden God is a big, big theme in devotional, pious, and mystical writings. I'm saying orthodox mystical writings. There are plenty of unorthodox mystical writings, and I'm sure the hidden God's in there too, but we don't care about unorthodox mystical writings. We're talking about writings by sincere believers who are not heretics, who talk about the hidden God. Well, that experience is common for all Christians, that God hides his face temporarily. Remember Job? We just went through the book of Job. God hid his face for a long time from Job. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about this experience of the hidden God. Quote, "Our prayers may go unanswered year after year. We may wrestle continually with a problem and never find spiritual insight to explain it. Or we may endure ongoing suffering with no relief in sight." That happens. It happened to Job. Of course, you've got to remember, at the end of the book of Job, Job got all of his stuff back. He was blessed. He was doing fine. Well, sometimes the reason why God hides his face from people, as the NIV Study Bible says, is because of sin. Because we sin. Because we're disobedient. Because we're hypocrites. Because we have wrong motives when we pray. Because we have a lack of faith. Or because we have marital problems. Well, then that's not a case of the hidden God, because there's a reason for that, and we can put our finger on it. But sometimes the reason why God hides himself from us is impossible to determine. Many Old Testament saints experienced this. I've already mentioned Job. How about Jeremiah? Where was God as Jeremiah prays for the deliverance of Israel from Babylon? Where was God when Jeremiah ends up in a pit? Where was God when Jeremiah is exiled to Egypt where he dies? You can't explain things like this. Jeremiah loved God and God loved Jeremiah, but bad things happened to him. How about Elijah as he runs from his contest with the prophets of Baal, ends up at Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, in a cave saying, "Where are you, God?" My notes say that Moses also experienced this. I don't know when Moses experienced God being hidden from him. Seems to me like Moses talked to God face to face. He was constantly talking to God in the tent of meeting. It doesn't seem to me that God was very hidden from him, but somebody thinks so. I'll have to think on that one. Even Jesus experienced the hidden God. Remember when he was on the cross and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, God hadn't actually abandoned Jesus. Some people think that God did actually abandon Jesus. I don't believe that for a minute. I think that's crazy theology, in my humble opinion. But even though God had not actually abandoned Jesus, Jesus in his humanity felt like God had abandoned him. God allowed that to happen so that in all things Jesus could suffer as a human, so he could completely identify with us as our high priest, as it says in the book of Hebrews. We had to have a human high priest. Now, even though the idea that God has hidden himself from the psalmist is everywhere present, or is often present in the Psalms, not always. Here's a place where David shows that God had not, hidden himself. Psalms 139, verse 7, David says this, "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence?" There God is not hiding himself, but is actively involved in God's life. So the bottom line is God is always with us, no matter how we feel. All right, there's another problem in the book of Psalms that we need to address, the problem of self-righteousness in the Psalms. Let me read Psalms 7-8 as an example. "The Lord judges the peoples. Vindicate me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and my integrity that is in me." Now, this is a psalm of David, and David says, "Judge me, vindicate me, according to my righteousness." I'm a righteous person, David says. Psalm 15:2, also a psalm of David. "He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart," he's referring to himself as someone who works righteousness. Well, how do we deal with that problem? Well, one way to deal with it is to say that David and the other psalmists who are saying that they're righteous, they say they're righteous, but they mean that they are righteous because that righteousness had been previously received from God through faith. We can see this in Psalm 18, verses 20 through 26. Verse 20, "The Lord has rewarded me," this is David, "the Lord has rewarded me, David, according to my righteousness." Oh, I'm righteous. "According to the cleanness of my hands," David says, "Oh, my hands are clean. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me." 21, "For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. I keep God's law." Verse 22, "For all his ordinances were before me, and I did not put away his statutes from me. I was also blameless with him." I'm a blameless person, David says. "And I kept myself from iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness." I'm righteous according to the cleanness of my hands and his eyes. My hands are clean, God. "With the kind you show yourself kind, I'm kind. With the blameless, I'm blameless, God. With the blameless, you show yourself blameless. With the pure, you show yourself pure." I'm pure, David says. Well, that's true. That's verses 20 through 26 of Psalm 18. But now when we read verses 28 through 33, immediately following, we see that that righteousness that David kept talking about came from God. Starting in verse 28, Psalm 18, David says, "For you, God, light my lamp. The Lord my God illumines my darkness. I am dark, you're bright. For by you I can run upon a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is blameless. The word of the Lord is tried. He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. God's way is blameless. For who is God but the Lord, and who is a rock except our God? The God who girds me with strength and makes my way blameless." So, yes, David was saying he was righteous and pure and blameless, but it was God who made his way blameless. I don't have any problem with that. Another way you can deal with the problem is by saying that David is claiming that he is relatively righteous. In other words, compared to idolaters, murderers, and blasphemers, David doesn't commit any egregious, notorious, and open sin. He's not claiming that he's sinlessly perfect, of course. Nobody would be stupid enough to claim that they were sinlessly perfect before God, especially when you're talking to God. But what he's saying is, compared to all the really bad sinners out there, I didn't do that kind of stuff. Well, he did murder somebody and commit adultery, but in general. Going along with this idea is the NIV Study Bible. David was speaking poetically. He considered himself innocent of wrongdoing, at least when he compared himself to the violence and wickedness of those around him. On other occasions, however, when he saw himself in light of God's holiness, he confessed his sin before God. And that's true. We need to remember that even though David said that, hey, I'm pure, I'm blameless, he wasn't talking about always, because in Psalm 51, after he sinned against Bathsheba by killing her husband and impregnating her, he wasn't talking about how righteous he was then. He was confessing his sin. Well, I think the NIV Study Bible is correct there. David is just saying that he's relatively righteous compared to grotesque sins. It could be that David is saying he is righteous in the same way that Job said he was righteous. He was righteous with respect to erroneous charges made against him by his enemies. I didn't do that particular thing. John Gill says, David's use of righteousness must be understood of the righteousness of David's cause and of his innocence with respect to the things he was charged with by his enemies. So either David is saying he's relatively righteous compared to most bad guys out there, or he's saying I'm righteous with respect to specific charges, or he's saying, yes, I'm righteous, but my righteousness came straight from God. Either way, we've solved the problem, I think. Now let's look at another problem in the book of Psalms, the meaning of the word forever. The Hebrew for that is olam. The word is difficult to translate. I've got a quote here, which I'm not going to read to you, from an intellectual Christian who talks about the ancient Hebrew concept of time is totally different from Westerners or modern people's concept of time. They didn't have clocks. They didn't have astronomy to regulate time. They had to use phases of the moon in agriculture, and so they didn't have the same idea of eternity that we do. So when the psalmist used forever, they don't necessarily mean eternity. Well, actually, the term olam, forever, sometimes it does mean eternity in the Old Testament. Sometimes it just means a long time. Here's some examples of where olam means eternity. When I say eternity, I mean at least eternity in the future, from a given point all the way to an endless time in the future. Maybe not toward the past, but at least toward the future. Genesis 21:33, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God, the God who lives forever. Well, that's obviously eternity, both backwards and forwards. Psalm 92:8, but you, O Lord, are on high forever. Well, that's eternity. That's world without end, because God is eternal. He doesn't cease to exist ever. Psalms 100 verse 5, for the Lord is good. His loving kindness is everlasting. God's loving kindness is never going to stop. It's forever, both backwards and forward, eternity. Psalm 119 verse 142, your righteousness, God's righteousness, is an everlasting righteousness. Well, God's righteousness never stops, so that's forever. There is not one second that is accepted on the timeline. From beginning of time to the end of time, it's all there. Everlasting righteousness. Psalm 145:13. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Same thing. Isaiah 40:28. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the eternal God, is forever. All right, so there's no problem that olam can mean eternity. But also, olam can mean a long time. But a long time short of eternity. For example, in Exodus 12:14, we read this, "This day," this is referring to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, "this day is to be a memorial for you, and you must celebrate it as a festival to the Lord. You are to celebrate it throughout your generation as a permanent," that word there is olam, I looked it up, "your generations as a permanent statute." Well, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is not going to go on forever and ever and ever on in eternity, world without end. It stops when the law stopped, when Jesus came and died on the cross and was resurrected and put an end to the Mosaic Law. It's interesting that the New American Standard Version there puts in the margin that permanent statute can be translated eternal statute. An eternal statute, the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Well, come on. After AD 70, when the polity of Judah was entirely destroyed, there was no Feast of Unleavened Bread, so how could it be permanent? Leviticus 3:17, "It is a perpetual," that's olam again, I looked that one up too, "it is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat any fat or any blood." That's a part of the Mosaic Law. You mean forever and ever and ever? Either backwards or forwards in time, we're not supposed to eat any fat? I'm not supposed to eat a steak with fat on the edges? Please! So, olam does not necessarily mean eternal. So when we see it in the Psalms, I'm going to interpret it by the context. The lexicons, by the way, agree with me on that. Here's Strong's lexicon, number 5679. Olam means, quote, "everlasting, forever, eternity, perpetual, evermore, throughout, for a duration." Eternity is not for a duration. So you see, the Strong's concordance gives two different definitions for that word, and those two definitions are not coterminous. Here is the Gesenius Hebrew Chaldee lexicon, quote, "eternity, perpetuity, everlasting, all the days of life." Well, eternity cannot be the same as all the days of life because people don't live for eternity. How about the Young's lexicon? An age, indefinite time. Young's doesn't even give the idea of eternity, although I think it's there, but I don't know why Young's doesn't put it there. But my point is that this is an overwhelming slam dunk case that olam does not always mean eternity. Sometimes it just means a long time, and that's very important. It shows up a lot in theology, for example, when legalists like Seventh-day Adventists want to say that the Sabbath is forever. Oh, there, see that, even to the end of time, we've got to follow the Old Testament law concerning the Sabbath and concerning not eating shrimp. Or when the dispensationalist says, oh, Israel is forever, the Old Testament Israel, and so therefore the millennial kingdom has got to be reestablished as the Jewish kingdom. Of course, that doesn't even make sense because if you take olam to mean eternity, that would include the period of time between AD 70 and 1948, where Israel was kaputsky. That's not eternal, unless you want to say eternity's got a huge gap in it. So you see, the word has interesting theological implications. Well, with all of that background, let us now cover Psalms chapter 1. It's just six verses. Psalm 1:1. "How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers." Now, Adam Clark says that Psalm 1 has generally been considered to be the introduction to the whole book of Psalms, with no special reason. That's interesting. I don't know why people would do that. "How blessed is the man," Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says you can translate that as, "oh, the happiness of the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked." Now, these three terms referring to bad guys, wicked, sinners, and scoffers, some see a progression in the evil of these men that are mentioned. This is according to Adam Clark. The wicked would be those uninfluenced by God. Sinners are those who go out and commit open sin. And scoffers are those who openly mock and blaspheme God personally. Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't want to be that precise about it, but basically the idea is these are bad guys. Don't listen to what they say. Walk in their counsel. Don't listen to them. Now, we need to make the point here, when the blessed man should not stand in the path of sinners, that word sinners there means open, notorious sin. It does not mean all of us who have inherited original sin from Adam, because that refers to everybody in the world. So the psalmist would not be saying, don't ever stand in the path of anybody in the world. If so, you couldn't get counsel from anyone. Don't listen to anybody in the world that's a sinner. Well, if you include everybody in the world as a sinner, well, just don't listen to anybody. Well, that's absurd. So it's talking about people who are obviously breaking the law or who are obviously immoral. Don't sit in the seat of scoffers, the psalmist says. Scoffers would be, according to Gill, deist and atheist, who scoff at divine revelation and mock at a future state, at death, hell, and judgment, and they are everywhere, especially since the internet came along. They love doing this. And you watch them snarl, and their lips bare, and their saliva starts dripping, and you think, my gosh, they are suppressing the truth and righteousness. They are shaking their fist at the God they know exists deep down in their hearts, and so they're going to keep pushing him away so that they will not have to be confronted with their horrible sin. We go down to Psalms chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. But his, that's the blessed man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law, and in God's law, he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. Now, what does the psalmist mean when he says his delight is in the law of the Lord? What's the law there? Well, it could be the law of nature written on all men, the law of our consciousness, but I do not think that's whom the psalmist was referring to. It could be the law of Moses. John Gill has an objection to that. He says, why would you delight in the law of Moses? Because Moses' law leads to condemnation. Well, I have an answer to that. Condemnation of sin is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. So we could meditate on all what's going to happen to the bad guys and think, thank God we're not one of those that are being condemned. So I don't have any problem with it being the law of Moses. But as Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest, the law of the Lord here could refer to the scriptures in general, at least as many of the scriptures as had been written by David's time. David ruled from 1010 to 970. And of course, Moses wrote the Pentateuch before then. And Job was written before then. I prefer that solution. The blessed man who does not stand in the counsel of sinners is delighting in all the scriptures of the Lord. You could just say he delights in the moral law of the Lord, but how would you know that without the scriptures? So let's just assume that's what he's talking about. And in God's law, this blessed man meditates day and night, just like Joshua was directed to do. Joshua 1:8 says, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Meditate means to memorize, to concentrate on, to repeat, to make it part of your being. It doesn't just mean to read it and then forget it. Now notice Joshua says your way will be prosperous. That's true in general, but remember, not always. You don't want to overgeneralize, because remember the book of Job? He wasn't prosperous. He didn't have success, at least for a time. He did at the end. The blessed man meditates day and night in verse 2. That means every chance he gets. It doesn't mean 24 hours out of every day. Of course not. Verse 3, the blessed man will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water. This is not a wild tree because it's planted. It's a tree that's cultivated for growth. We want to make this thing grow apples or whatever. Likewise, the Christian wants to make himself grow fruit, so he plants. Where? By streams of water. Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say those streams are canals for irrigation, man-made things. In other words, it's something you do to get a tree. It's not a wild tree. It's a cultivated tree, and the idea is the blessed man will cultivate his fruit by planting himself or getting himself planted by streams of water, where the water of life is. To make the application today, that of course would be where Jesus is, where he's being preached, where he's being taught, where he's being lived out in community. And this tree that's firmly planted by streams of water yields its fruit. Well, what kind of fruit might that be referring to? Graces of the Spirit, good works. You want to be a godly Christian bearing fruit? You got to meditate on the law of the Lord, on his scriptures. Are you listening, pietist? Are you listening, charismatics? Which yields its fruit in its season. Now remember, I am a charismatic myself, so I have the right to say that. Which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. Leaf does not wither, even when it's not raining, because you got the streams of water coming from below. Streams of water coming from Jesus. Whatever this blessed man who doesn't sit in the seat of scorners, whatever he does, he prospers. Now what does prosper mean? Just like Joshua 1:8 says, if you meditate, you prosper. What does it mean? Well, in general, the word means you will have success. Here is how the ancient Hebrews defined success. A successful man would have a positive reputation and community respect. A successful person would have God's blessings on one's words and deeds, spiritual blessings, and it could include money. But remember, prosperity does not exclusively mean financial blessings. Now, why do I need to say that? Because in Western culture, at least in American culture, prosperity automatically means money, having money. But that's not what the Hebrew words mean here, not exclusively. And I also have to mention it because, of course, the famous name it and claim it, blab it and crab it, scream it and redeem it, mark it and park it, confess it and possess it, word of faith heretics are constantly talking about money. Now, I must say here, though, that in denouncing these folks, we need to remember that, yes, prosperity, it does include money. A lot of times people need money, especially young couples that got little kids. Oh, my gosh, you're short of money. I know several young couples now who that's what they're thinking about because they have trouble supporting their family. They don't have a lot of experience. They have children that are expensive. They have a lot of money they need to spend just to get by. Well, yeah, God will make them prosperous financially, too. I mean, in denouncing the Copenhagenites, should we become the party of sickness and poverty? To get rid of the prosperity message, should we become the poverty preachers? I don't think so. That's absurd. So a little balance is needed here. So meditation offers a principle of success, not a guarantee of success. I've already mentioned that when I mentioned Joshua 1:8. There are exceptions to that, as in the book of Job. And how about Hebrews 11? Are we going to call them losers because they had their goods taken away from them? That's not prosperity. That's not financial prosperity. That's not even success in a general use of the term prosperity. They ended up in jail. So we go down to Psalm 1, verses 4 and 5. The wicked are not so. In other words, they're not prosperous, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. Now, the wicked are not so, not how. They're not prosperous, but they're like chaff. Chaff is the husk of grain. You put the unwinnowed grain on a pitchfork. You throw it up in the air. The wind blows the chaff away because the chaff is very light. And you say bye-bye to it. Well, that's what happens to the wicked. They're not rooted like a tree by the water. They're like chaff that the wind drives away, which means they're going to get blown away. Their house is going to fall when the rains come. Verse 5, the wicked will not stand in the judgment. Now, what does that mean, judgment? Does it mean temporal judgment? Well, that obviously can't be so because wicked people do suffer temporal judgment. So the psalm would be telling a lie. The wicked will not stand in temporal judgment. They'll never be temporally judged. No. Well, how about eternal judgment? The wicked will not suffer eternal judgment in hell. Well, that's a lie too. Rob Bell might not know that, but it's true. So what does it mean? Well, it means the judgment seat of Christ where Christ passes out rewards. The wicked will not stand before the judge so that the judge might give him a positive judgment. I mean, I used to practice law, and lawyers constantly say, I need a judgment. They don't mean they want to get bad things happen to them. They want the judge to sign a judgment that lets their client off or grants something to their client. So the wicked will not get rewarded. And again, this is generally because sometimes the wicked do prosper, as the book of Job pointed out. Sinners will not stand in the assembly of the righteous. Well, now, that's not true of the United States Congress, I'll tell you that. But that's not an assembly of righteous people. We know eternally that's going to be true. There won't be any sinners in heaven, but I don't think the psalmist is talking about eternity. He's talking about on earth, and what he means is we don't want sinners in the assembly of the righteous. And of course, that doesn't mean all of mankind. Once again, it means sinners who commit open, notorious sins. It's a good verse here for church discipline, by the way. You don't want sinners in your church. If somebody's committing open adultery, open sexual harassment, or open whatever, no. You don't let them stand in the assembly of the righteous in the church. You excommunicate them. Hopefully they'll get restored. That's the purpose of excommunication, but church discipline needs to be done. We go now to Psalm 1:6, and we'll finish chapter 1 of the Psalms. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And of course, that's ultimately the day of judgment. The wicked will perish, but sometimes the ways of the wicked will flourish on this earth, as in the book of Job. Ladies and gentlemen, we're finished with Psalm 1. I need to add here that I forgot to mention who wrote the psalm. Well, we actually don't know. There's nobody attributed as author in the title, the heading of the book of Psalms. So this is an anonymous psalm, as is our next psalm, which we're now prepared to go to. We will call that Psalm 2, the reign of the Lord's anointed. I hope you stay tuned with me for the discussion of Psalm 2, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.